society is found in Malachi chapter 4 and verses 5 and 6 of that chapter, and I want to call your attention to these verses because this is the theme of our study in these last two or three weeks. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. The families and the homes are one of our most urgent needs for help in this day and age. And over and over and over, it's being advertised that our homes need help. And families live in homes, and that's where our children grew up. And we're studying about the home. And I'd like to suggest to you that there's nothing finer concerning the correction of the family and the home and the healing of the home than these few chapters found in Ministry of Healing. Now, you have to look at them and look at them and look at them. The Lord gives words so simple and so simply written that we assume there's not much more than the simple words. And he wrote them simply so all could understand, even the poorly educated. And the well-educated assume that since they're not complicated thoughts or words, there's not too much there, but there's very much there. You must always assume that omniscience has written these words. And therefore, the wisest human being will barely understand them superficially, the wisest. And except the Lord would teach us, we would find almost nothing there because our understanding and our minds are so feeble as compared to the all-wise God. Now, he wants to communicate, and he's trying to impress us. And the clues are found here to make a happy home and a joyful home. And I hope that you begin to look at them very carefully, and they become more than a theory to us. We put them into practice in our future of our families and homes. Remember now, this chapter, Preparation of the Home, is called Choice and Preparation of the Home, has to do with much more than we realize in a book on healing. I want to go back to that quotation referred to again last week, page 349 of Ministry of Healing. The restoration and uplifting of humanity begins in the home. The restoration and uplifting of humanity begins in the home. The work of parents underlies every other. Society is composed of families and is what the heads of families make it. Out of the heart are the issues of life, the Bible says, and the heart of the community and of the church and of the nation is the household. The well-being of society, the success of the church, the prosperity of the nation depend upon home influences. We'll never accomplish much beginning elsewhere. The restoration and uplifting of humanity is there. It includes you and me, our children, our neighbors, all of our society, all of our nation, and we must learn how to follow this counsel wisely. Now, this chapter, Choice and Preparation of the Home, is another one in this area of healing. And it doesn't even mention the word healing, to my knowledge, in the whole chapter. So you'll quickly go through it and say it's not talking about healing. But you must read it very carefully and you begin to see it. It's introduced by a verse from the Bible back in Genesis 2 and verse 8. A very simple verse, and it says, "And the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed." That simply. Planted a garden, he put man into it. That was the first home. Correct? And there he put our first parents. And that place was called what? Eden, and what's another name for it? Paradise. That was paradise. A garden, and he put man into it. That was paradise. Those very simple words, that's all you have to have. A garden with men in it, paradise. Right? And there's a tremendous sermon there and tremendous blessings. And choose that to introduce where would you locate your home and how would you prepare it to live in so far as healing is concerned. Remember, that's the theme of all this. Now she has some of the criteria in the choice or place of a home listed there on page 361. And some of these we'll not understand very carefully. We must read them over and over again. I want to begin now on page 363. I said 361. 363, really. And I want you to notice the general theme that she uses to establish the preparation and choice of a home. She gives a great, broad, general spectrum, first of all, as to how we should think about this. The gospel is a wonderful simplifier of life's problems. The gospel, wonderful simplifier of life's problems. Its instruction, heeded, would make plain many a perplexity and save us from many an error. just the gospel. Make plain many a perplexity, save us from many an error. It teaches us to estimate things at their true value and to give the most effort to the things of greatest worth. Their true value and those of the greatest worth. The things that will endure. We live in such a temporary society and we think in such the immediate future, but nothing down the road awaits. And we leave eternity out. She says, you must put into this the things that will endure. The gospel teaches that this is of the greatest worth. This lesson is needed by those upon whom rests the responsibility of selecting a home. And now, selecting a home, think about the things of greatest worth, the things that will endure. And she's probably thinking about something else than you are. They should not allow themselves to be diverted from the highest aim, the things that will endure, you see, the greatest worth. Let them remember that the home on earth is to be a symbol of and a preparation for the home in heaven. So the one we have here is a symbol of the one in heaven. It's a preparation for it as well. So think about the hereafter, which will go on and on and on for eternity, when you think about your home down here. It's a preparation for it. You see, in a symbol of it. Life is a training school from which parents and children are to be graduated to the higher school in the mansions of God. And the school building is a home, you see. So here we go to school in our homes to be graduated to one above. And that's what she's trying to tell us about our homes. As the location for a home is sought, let this purpose direct the choice. Where will you put your schoolhouse? That's what she's talking about. Where will you put your schoolhouse? The home that's a symbol of heaven and a preparation for the school in heaven. And this is the first thought now. The home is sought, let this purpose direct the choice. Be not controlled by the desire for wealth, the dictates of fashion, or the customs of society. Consider what will tend most to simplicity, purity, health, and real worth. Consider what now? What will tend most to simplicity, purity, health, and real worth. Omit desire for wealth, dictates of fashion, customs of society. Leave all that out. Emphasize first, you see, simplicity, purity, health, and real worth. By real worth, she means the things that will endure. Now, if you begin to think about the type of school she's speaking about here in the home, a school that prepares us for the school of the hereafter, this is the greatest type of therapy or healing you can find. The healing of the soul that prepares us for eternal life, or equips us for eternal life, is the greatest medicine there is. Is that not true? The greatest healing. The healing of the body is only temporary. You only live a few years, but there you live everlastingly. So the healing of the soul and the preparation for that school that you'll never graduate from is the greatest healing there is. So she talks about the home and things will endure. She's talking about preparing for everlasting life and that kind of healing. That's a different kind of healing we usually think about. It's a preventive medicine or a corrective. In some cases, we've all been in sin, you see. So it gets us ready and equips us by healing our souls. It gets us ready for heaven. It says, now think about that first. That's of more value than anything else. And this school aspect is the prime motive for the home. You must prepare your children, yourselves for heaven, for that school there. Let this purpose direct the choice. So she really has a progression of ideas. Sort out your value system. Which is the greatest value? The things that endure everlastingly or the things that pass away tomorrow or a week from now or a year from now or 10 years from now or 50 years from now? Which are the most valuable? Are we really sensible? Do we really use good judgment in our value system? Then when you choose a home, choose first of all the criteria or the location of that home of greatest value, the preparation for the hereafter. The school on earth prepares for the school in heaven. She said, put that first, and everything will be fine. Now, the first thing she launches into, as many of you would guess, is why it should not be located in the city. And this is the finest discussion about why we should not live in the city of anything I've ever read. And I hope you take time to read it most carefully, for there's just paragraph after paragraph after paragraph, and they're very, very scientifically written with great logic. Begins about on page 363 in that first paragraph. And each paragraph approaches from a different perspective. But it's all centering around what's wrong with city living. Number one, what's wrong with it? The world over, cities are becoming hotbeds of vice. Every hand are the sights and sounds of evil. Everywhere enticements to sensuality and dissipation. The tide of corruption and crime is continually swelling. Every day brings the record of violence, robberies, murders, suicides, crimes unnameable. She said, every city in the world is like that. Now, that's enough. But she continues on from a different viewpoint. Page 364. Life in the cities is false and artificial. Now, each one of these thoughts, you could spend a whole evening on a discussion group. How is life in the city false and artificial? How is it like that? We read these words and hardly think about them, but there's so many things that are false and artificial in a city. So many things. And by the way, we live in a city. This is too close to other cities to be called a village anymore. It might be a bedroom community, but it's still a city. She goes on and talks about other things included in this, and some of these are false and artificial as well. The intense passion for money getting. All cities are like that. An intense passion, obsession for money getting. The whirl of excitement and pleasure seeking. Aren't these marvelous descriptions? That's all around us. The thirst for display. Just, you know, it's automatic. You live in a city. That's what everybody does. Do you want to be an oddball, you know, a square or whatever you want to call it? So all this is around us. The thirst for display, the luxury and extravagance, all are forces that with the great masses of mankind are turning the mind from life's true purpose. They are opening the door to 1,000 evils. Upon the youth they have almost irresistible power. And so don't get mad at your children growing in the cities, you know, if they do these things. You chose them to do it. It's almost impossible for them to resist the power of these influences. So if you train them in that city, they'll be like the city. Right? Don't get upset because your children are so sinful and so terrible, you know. They grew up poor. Everybody did that. Right? And they learn from everybody else. Has an almost irresistible power. So we put them into that area where we have guaranteed vulnerability, with rare exception, and we ask ourselves, why aren't they different? They can't be different, except in rare occasions. They can't be different. Has an almost irresistible power. She goes on, one of the most subtle and dangerous temptations that assail the children and youth in the cities is the love of pleasure. She said it's more there than it is in the country. Holidays are numerous, games and horse racing draw thousands. The whirl of excitement and pleasure attracts them away from the sober duties of life. Money that should have been saved for better use is frittered away for amusements. Now just look among our young people today. What is the one big attraction? Pleasure seeking, right? It almost defeats every Seventh-day Adventist. Right? And you think you are nobody if you don't have plenty of time for pleasure. If you just can't do all the pleasureful things that others are doing, you know, you feel like you're way down low someplace, you know, left out. When the other kids are going, talking about going to mammoth skiing, you say, oh, you know, if I could only go there. And I've arrived when I've gone to mammoth, right? Or to Utah or to Colorado or someplace. And finally, that's not good enough, I want to go to Europe. There's Seventh-day Adventists doing that every year, right? Not finding fault with skiing, but it's just pure pleasure seeking often, isn't it? It just has an attraction about it. And she said, it's so subtle and dangerous, the temptation. And we just get an obsession to do this all the time. And the worst thing about it, it attracts them away from the sober duties of life. Try to get them to come home and mow the lawn after that. Talk about a come down, you know. It's almost like hitting them over the head. No wonder they hate work, you see, and why we don't like to do those things when we spend so much of our life in pleasure seeking. Now, the bottom of the page, it talks about another influence from a wholly different perspective. And this one, not so much about the young people as those who are making a living. Through the working of trusts, and I assume this means the big industries. It could mean other things too. Through the working of trusts, and on the opposite side, the results of labor unions and strikes, the conditions of life in the city are constantly becoming more and more difficult. So whether it be big industry, or the labor unions and strikes, it becomes more and more difficult. Serious troubles are before us, and for many families, removal from the cities will become a necessity. Removal is a necessity. I'm amazed at how slow we are to catch on. Aren't we? How entrenched we are, just like the dwellers in Sodom, who refused to leave. And it didn't matter how corrupt it became, they liked it there. Who can love Sodom? We literally do. Do you know that? We literally do. On Fridays, you can see us running to get away, but on Sunday night, you see us racing to get back. Because we say it's the only place we can live. Do people really live in Sodom, or do they die? And do we call this living? If so, shouldn't we have a new definition for living? Is the rat race you're living in living? Is it really? Is that living? Is that what you want for your children? Just to run, and suddenly die from running all their lives? And never had time to enjoy it. Living in the influences we see all around us. We quickly pervert things because of our backgrounds and our surroundings. She continues on with further comments about the cities on page 365. The physical surroundings in the cities are often a peril to health. Now she just leaves all the others entirely and comes another perspective. The physical surroundings. The constant liability to contact with disease. So many people, you see. The country's not like that. The prevalence of foul air, Southern California style, right? Impure water. Have you read the papers about impure water? In many, many cities. Impure water. Impure food. The crowded, dark, unhealthful dwellings are some of the many evils to be met. I shall never forget the first time Mrs. Lehman and I stayed in Chicago in a hotel right next to the elevator train. Same level. Our bedroom was there, you know. And all night long, that abominable thing rattled by. And all around you could see people. It was a warm evening like this. You see people. And they lived there 365 days a year. I wonder if they even take a vacation. And they called that living. And we had come from the sticks or the boondocks, whatever you'd call it, you know. And we couldn't understand how human beings could live in a place like that. Have you ever been at Times Square at midnight? Even 30 years ago, you know. When it's supposed to be less evil than it is now. It's unbelievable, you know. They live on those, way down those canyons, like live in the bottom of Grand Canyon with no birds and no nature, concrete tunnels, and they live there all their lives, some people. And they just dearly love it. Talk to them. They defend living there as the finest place in the world to live. Didn't you? Have you ever talked to them? I have. They think the poor, wretched souls that live out there are hillbillies, where we live out in California, you know. Where rattlesnakes are attacking us all the time and everything else. They're frightened to come out here. And they think they defend that as the proper place to live. So she talks about these crowded, dark, unhealthful dwellings are some of the many evils to be met. Some of us live in places like that right here. Then she goes on and says, it was not God's purpose that people should be crowded into cities, huddled together in terraces and tenements. Not his purpose at all. In the beginning, he placed our first parents amidst the beautiful sights and sounds he desires us to rejoice in today. This very day. Amid the beautiful sights and sounds he desires to rejoice in today. The more nearly we come into harmony with God's original plan, back in the garden, you see, the more favorable will be our position to secure health of body and mind and soul. There's healing. The more nearly we copy that original plan, you see, go back and locate in a place like that, the more favorable will be our position to secure health of body and mind and soul. Many of us are killing ourselves by where we live. And we call this intelligence and good judgment. And don't realize that it's guaranteed death. And I wonder when we're going to find out in our health institutions, you know, how much the location contributes to the death of mankind. And how long would we lengthen the lifespan of human beings if we could change the location of where human beings live? In the Reader's Digest a couple, 3 years ago, it talked about a location in south central Nebraska where the people live the longest of any place in the United States. But I notice it's miles and miles and miles from any major city of any kind. Just a tiny little village out there. And it named three or four locations which have the longest lifespan for the population in that area. And they're all in very rural locations, every one of them. You talk about the Hunzas, and they don't hardly have any cities there, is that right? They're almost totally missing. And in southern Russia, where they live so long, all living in rural areas. So wherever you find long live people, you usually find them in the country. And she's telling us this over and over again and giving us many, many reasons from a variety of perspectives as to why we should not live in these places. Now, we think livelihood is more important, but livelihood will not keep you alive in these places for very long. We need more than money to live, don't we? Far more than that. Money is only temporary, and the life you're talking about is very temporary too. She's talking about the abundant life here and everlasting life there. And it cannot be found in some of these places. Now, this is a very interesting topic, and you can talk about it for hours. The first city was found where, by the way? Who built the first city? Someone said Cain. No, it's in Genesis 11, verse 4. The most wicked descendants of Noah, Nimrod and his family, built the Tower of Babel, and that was the first city. Read Genesis 11. It talks about how they're all one language and one speech in verse 1. They journeyed from the east to the plain of the land of Shinar, the plain there, and dwelt there. And they said, let's make us brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime they had for mortar. They said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. Let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Now this verse says more than most people recognize and more than I have usually seen it at too. In Patriarchs and Prophets, page 119, Ellen White comments on their enterprise in doing this. These enterprises were designed to prevent the people from scattering abroad in colonies, this building of the Tower of Babel. Nimrod didn't want them scattered abroad. God had directed men to disperse throughout the earth. So this was completely contrary to God's directions. God had directed men to disperse throughout the earth to replenish and subdue it. But these Babel builders determined to keep their community united in one body, and to found a monarchy that should eventually embrace the whole earth. That's the first Catholic movement. Catholic means universal. Thus their city would become the metropolis of a universal empire. Its glory would command the admiration and homage of the world and render the founders illustrious. The magnificent tower reaching to the heavens was intended to stand as a monument of the power and wisdom of its builders, perpetuating their fame to the latest generations. They really had a chamber of commerce, didn't they? And we've had them ever since and think they're good things. This is why they had it. These, so far as we understand, were the first city builders. And they did this in complete opposition to God's commands for them. And they did this to keep from going out into the country. And to get power, they united themselves together in rebelling against God, and God came down and destroyed that place. And confounded their languages so they would have to be scattered abroad. They couldn't understand each other. Maybe the nicest thing that could happen to Americans is to have about 1,000 dialects. So we just couldn't understand people from Nevada or even from over the mountains up in the high desert. And so as out in Africa, we'd stay miles apart from each other because we'd distrust those foreign devils, as they call each other, whom they can't understand. And that might scatter us abroad instead of concentrating together in these places. But this is what we have done, and God wanted us to go out. And so Babel was the first city, the Tower of Babel. And there are many Babylonians in the Adventist Church, aren't there? Many, many of us. We just love Nimrod. And we build our Towers of Babel and defend them as nobly as he did. And don't realize we're doing that. Now, she goes on contrasting country living. She gives the example of Christ, and she says some things about him that are very unique on page 365. And she introduced this one sentence, an expensive dwelling, elaborate furnishings, display, luxury and ease do not furnish the conditions essential to a happy, useful life. You won't find it in those things. And our society in the last 20 years is showing that children from very wealthy homes with all these things have some of the greatest problems. And yet we're trying to copy their homes. that will not furnish us the conditions essential to a happy, useful life. None of those things. Jesus came to this earth to accomplish the greatest work ever accomplished among men. The greatest work. God sent him to do that. Now, what did God design for his environment? He came as God's ambassador to show us how to live so as to secure life's best results. So from his birth on, he came to show us how to live to achieve life's best results. So now that's what it means, all this description about him. What were the conditions chosen by the infinite Father for his Son? What did God choose for Jesus? And here's a description following. A secluded home in the Galilean hills. Apparently he didn't live right in Nazareth. A secluded home in the Galilean hills. A household sustained by honest, self-respecting labor. That's how they existed. A life of simplicity. Daily conflict with difficulty and hardship. Going on to page 366. With hardship, self-sacrifice, economy, patient, gladsome service. The hour of study at his mother's side. All these things went together. With the open scroll of Scripture. The quiet of dawn or twilight in the green valley. The holy ministries of nature. Ministries. Holy ministries of nature, she calls them. The study of creation and providence, and the soul's communion with God. These were the conditions and opportunities of the early life of Jesus. Now, we don't call those opportunities. We call them curses. Isn't that right? Honest, self-respecting labor, life of simplicity, daily conflict with difficulty and hardships, self-sacrifice, economy, patient, gladsome service, then the hour of study at his mother's side with the open scrolls, quiet dawn or twilight in the green valley, the holy ministries of nature, the study of creation and providence, soul's communion with God. These are the conditions, the opportunities of the early life of Jesus. And God designed these to be duplicated. This was his pattern for us to follow. And he said, if you really want to graduate to the school of hereafter, follow the example where I put my son. I planned for him, not Joseph. Isn't that right? Since I planned for him and provided, follow my plans. I love you just like I loved him. Isn't that right? Since I love you, I'd like you to live in just as nice a place as he did, with all those hardships and all those trials and all those difficulties. And not too much to eat. That's hard on us too, isn't it? And all these other things, these opportunities. But think of the good things, you know. Twilight, the quiet of dawn or twilight in the green valley. How long has it been since you've seen dawn in a green valley? And how long has it been since you've had an opportunity to sit down and watch the sun go down in a green valley, a smogless one? And he lived in a place like that. And it said, the holy ministries of nature, the study of creation and providence, soul's communion with God, out in nature, all these things. She goes on and says, so are the great majority of the best and noblest men of all ages. Read the history of Abraham, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, David, Elisha. Read about them. Study the lives of men of later times who have most worthily filled positions of trust and responsibility. The men whose influence has been most effective for the world's uplifting. How many of these were reared in country homes? They knew little of luxury. They did not spend their youth in amusement. They're forced to struggle with poverty and hardship, these leaders. They'd early learned to work. And their active life in the open air gave vigor and elasticity to all their faculties. Forced to depend upon their own resources, they learned to combat difficulties and to surmount obstacles. And they gained courage and perseverance. They learned the lessons of self-reliance and self-control. Sheltered in a great degree from evil associations, they were satisfied with natural pleasures and wholesome companionships. Now, God is not against pleasures, but they were satisfied with natural pleasures and wholesome companionships. They were simple in their tastes and temperate in their habits. They were governed by principle, and they grew up pure and strong and true. When called to their life work, they brought to it physical and mental power, buoyancy of spirit, ability to plan and execute, and steadfastness in resisting evil that made them a positive power for good in the world. Because they were healed by where they lived, they became a healing influence on the whole world. Right? They had these noble attributes, you see, of courage, and decision, hard work. They didn't fear these things. because they grew up in childhood like this and it didn't bother them a bit. It became very natural to face difficulties and hardships and make decisions about them. When you learn that in childhood, you know they're not so bad when you get older. In fact, they're quite easy. And this is one value of the depression which so many Adventists have hated. We've always thought if we could only undo the depression and do more for our kids than we had for ourselves. But we left out the blessings of the depression, didn't we? Going hungry was good for us. Having to work was very good for us. And we've robbed our children of the blessings we had in our hatred of the depression. And we probably hated the greatest blessing we ever had. And we go back and brag about when it was so hard for us in those days. It wasn't so difficult. We had difficulties, but they made us stronger people. And we, in opposing those things that come along to make our children weak, and we've done it with malice almost and trying to destroy them. God wasn't cursing us then. Now, these are some of the things, the comparisons on both sides, back and forth, as to why God would like to have us in the country. And I could say very much about this. The book Country Living and the book that used to be in print From City to Country Living has printed a great number of the quotations by Ellen White about this. And if I understand anything about it, there are degrees or steps of progress in moving to the country. The first step, she said, should be living outside of the cities and commuting to the cities to make a livelihood for the father or mother, whoever it might be, and to do missionary work. That's the first step. Live from the outside of the cities. These huge metropolises like Los Angeles is probably impossible. It's too far to commute. But there are many cities like Fresno and Bakersfield and Sacramento and places like that where it's easy to commute a few miles to town and live in the country. And she said, our schools should always be in the country. Our churches in the city. Our churches to be evangelistic centers and our schools to be training for our children. Two different purposes. And we should live in the country and come back in the city to work for the Lord and to work for livelihood. As we near the end of time, she said, the first step should be moving to the smaller towns. Get out of the big cities. And she's written that in many, many places. Get out of the cities. Get out of the cities. I think we have many indications starting quite a few years ago that we ought to get in the smaller towns. And I'm wishing for the day when you lose your job and have to go to a smaller town to find one. And that'll be an answer to a prayer. That'll be a blessing to you. And the Lord will probably have to evict us with angels as he did Lot and his family. Probably have to drag us out by the hair. Because we are so in love with these places, thinking we're blessed there when we're really cursed. But it'll be a happy day when we all lose our jobs in the city. God will be smiling upon Seventh-day Adventists and will think he's cursed us. And we'll pray and pray, oh, Lord, send us a living here. And he said, just get out of ways, you know, and I'll be glad to feed you. Right? Get out of Egypt, get out in the wilderness, and I'll pour it down from heaven. Stay here, and you'll get no manna. Right? No manna in the cities at all. The manna all came in the wilderness. Is that true? And God will never send manna in the cities because he wants us elsewhere. Now, that's the interim step. Getting out to smaller towns. And I really believe now we're failing in soul winning in the cities. I think the ripest place for soul winning today are the smaller towns. These people are aware of the evils of the cities. They have a little more objective opinion about them, those things, and they're more ripe, I think, at the present time. I would not forsake the soul winning in the cities. But I think the ripest place now are the smaller towns. I honestly do. I might be a heretic in believing that, and I might be ever so wrong. That's fine. Disagree with me all you wish. But I think it is there. I think many people are proving it. Just last Sunday night, a lady called me on the phone, who will be here a couple weeks from now, and three retired people went from Oregon down to West Texas, a place called Saragossa. And it's just a very small town. And in 3 years' time, they went from three Adventists to 96. Retired people, no young people, doing the work. A retired school teacher in her 70s said, Elder Raymond, I'm 74. She said, most of these Bible studies have been given by me. And all these people are baptized from outside the Adventist church. They're not someone who went there to live, you see, from elsewhere. They're all new converts. And they had their graduation last Saturday night, and one of the pastors back there was telling about our project back in Hobbs, New Mexico. And she's calling us to find if we can find a retired pastor from here to come back there and help them out. They need some help. And she wanted me to advertise, so I'm advertising right now. And I said, they're pretty old in our church. She said, I'm 74. Send as old as they are. She said, we'll be glad to have them. We need somebody. Come and help us out. Now, a small place like that, almost 100 members in 3 years. You know, it makes us ashamed of ourselves here, doesn't it? And these are untrained people, too old to work, by many people's criteria of judgment, you see? So there are steps to getting out in the country. And we ought to believe that God has divinely blessed us with wisdom that others don't have. And the blessing of that wisdom, He's trying to bless us with food and clothing, trying to bless our children and spare them from evil, and trying to get us all ready for the school of the hereafter, that blessed home where we'll never part again, and take with us millions of people to live in that wonderful place that the Lord has made for us. So these are some of His plans. And I must race on now to tell you a little bit more about some of this. She speaks then about the healing results of such a location of a home in the country, on the bottom of page 366 and top of page 367. Better than any other inheritance of wealth you can give to your children will be the gift of a healthy body, a sound mind, and a noble character. Now, where are those obtained? The right choice of a home in the country, you see. But any other gift you can give them, the gift of a healthy body, a sound mind, a noble character. Those who understand what constitutes life's true success will be wise betimes, before time, in other words. They will keep in view life's best things in their choice of a home. She goes on and said, instead of dwelling where only the works of men can be seen, where the sights and sounds frequently suggest thoughts of evil, where turmoil and confusion bring weariness and disquietude, go where you can look upon the works of God. In other words, it's bad to always be looking at men's buildings and men's cars and men's accomplishments. She said, in the cities, we're always looking at men, the works of men. Go where you can look upon the works of God. What does it say in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 18? It says that by beholding, we're changed in the likeness of the things we behold, right? So as you look upon the works of men, you become more like men. And all men are sinful. Look upon the works of God and you become like God. So just the beholding where men live, you know, it's better to get away from them. And behold the things of God, you become like Him. Let the eye rest upon the, find the rest of spirit and the beauty and quietude and peace of nature. Let the eye rest on the green fields, the groves and hills. Look up to the blue sky, unobscured by the city's dust and smoke, and breathe the invigorating air of heaven. Go where apart from the distractions and dissipations of city life, you can give your children your companionship, where you can teach them to learn of God through His works and train them for lives of integrity and usefulness. The reasoning this woman gives is just unbelievable, isn't it? She just literally just traps you and just embraces you with evidence from every direction, and you can't wiggle to get out of it at all. And she's saying, how can you say you're sensible and still stay in those places? And how much more we would learn if we went out and walked with God. The next, the last section deals with the furnishings of a home. And while it speaks about the ladies most, we men ought to learn how to bless them in this respect. For she's talking about giving mothers more time. That doesn't mean lengthening the day. It means shortening their duties and eliminating duties. She starts out on page 367, our artificial habits deprive us of many blessings and much enjoyment and unfit us for living the most useful lives, artificial habits. Elaborate, expensive furnishings are a waste, not only of money, but of that which is a thousandfold more precious. They bring into the home a heavy burden of care and labor and perplexity. These luxurious furnishings. She goes and talks about the work of the mother in the household. She talks about what we hang on the walls, the kind of furniture we have, and how much labor it takes to keep those up. In other writings, she talks about the kind of clothing we have for our children that require endless pressing and sewing and fixing up, too much care. And she believes in labor-saving devices, if you read these paragraphs carefully, that shorten the amount of time that the mother must spend in doing some of the household duties. And the reason for this is to give her time to be with her children and to be with her God and to be with her husband and to see God in nature. She says that we should have that time, and mothers ought to have that time. In my ministry, so many, many husbands have come to me and say, my wife is having problems. She doesn't want to go to prayer meeting. She doesn't want to go to Sabbath school. She doesn't want to do this, doesn't want to do that. And she seems to be getting very, very cold. I wish you'd do something for her. And all you have to do is ask the question, no, when do you give her time to do anything else but housework? Well, that's her job. And there are too many husbands who think that they're the only ones that have the opportunity to sit down away from the children, you know, and study for a while. And then they wonder why their wife is not a Christian. When they've driven her away by just giving her nothing but work, 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 and no time for God. And some of us think that's good. Some of us want wives like that. And we wonder why they'll not train our children up to be Christians. They lose their own souls. And we just overwhelm them with duties to perform again and again and again, and God does not want that. So she talks about simple furnishings and a house that's easy to take care of, simple clothing, simple duties, and then the wife can have so much. And I love the picture found in this chapter in Ministry of Healing, where it shows the mother with a child walking down the path barefoot, and the cow with a calf walking down the same path. I don't think there's a finer picture in any place in the world than the mother, total at ease, you know, barefoot, out walking down the pasture with her child, and the calf and its mother side by side. I think it's in the old Ministry of Healing, not in the new one, isn't that right? It's not in the new one, it's in the older one. And I wish they wouldn't left it out. It's such a wonderful picture. I wish someone would paint it so we can have it in our homes. And Ellen White used that as an example, you know, what life ought to be for a mother. How many of you ladies would like to be like that? You know? Just take your children by the hand. You know, I have a terrible time in counseling with mothers to just get them out of the house. There are many a mother I've told who has problems, severe emotional problems. I said, why don't you just go over to the park, and I'm talking about cities now, and just put your children in the swing or whatever it is, the teeter-totter or the merry-go-round, you know, and just sit. Or just walk in the grass with them. Stay out there half a day. I know a girl that was confined to psych wards for years. She was there when she was 12 years of age. She was there when she was in her 20s. And I said, just refuse to go inside the house. Get up in the morning and in an hour just get things together. And I said, I'll tell your husband to stop criticizing your housekeeping and everything else and just take your children and go outside. She had two lovely children. And I said, the children will like it and you'll like it. And just being out of doors is a blessing. Many people with a habit of smoking, if you just keep them out of doors all day long, they'll stop smoking. All smokers smoke less out of doors than indoors. Always. And especially where it's breezy because they don't see the smoke anymore. And they don't like that. There's some charm about watching the smoke rise. And the wind blows it away, it's no fun. And they're not chain smokers out of doors like they are indoors. All sorts of habits, emotional problems, alcoholism, drug problems, I think would be greatly reduced out of doors. I know they are. And many, many physical problems. Many a patient is resurrected to newness of life by just fresh air out of doors and the scenes of nature round about them. If only would just get out. Just get out. I think in this city that we live in, that we would accomplish a miracle. We pooled our funds and paid somebody to go out here and got some rights to do it and bulldoze some paths up through the hills like the British have done in foreign countries out in India. And they have paths 4 foot wide going back in the mountains for 15, 20 miles so people can go out in the mountains easily, not with motorbikes and not with jeeps. Walk. That's what I mean, walk. And they walk 15, 20 miles. I was there at rest camp up in India, way up in the Himalayas. And what a wonderful place to walk. You could just walk for hours. Most enjoyable. But you must put those places there to entice people to do it. It'd be real therapy for many people living in Loma Linda. And I must race on now. As you come down near the end of this section on furnishing your home, page 369, let the homemakers resolve to live on a wiser plan. Let it be your first aim to make a pleasant home. Be sure to provide the facilities that will lighten labor and promote health and comfort. Plan for the entertainment of the guests whom Christ has bidden to welcome. Who are those? The poor who cannot bid you again. Skipping there down a little bit further, second paragraph. Furnish your home with things plain and simple, things that will bear handling, that can be easily kept clean, that can be replaced without great expense. By exercising taste, you can make a very simple home attractive and inviting if love and contentment are there. And what does the Bible say? A merry heart doeth good like a what? If love and contentment are there, you see, these surroundings can make it peaceful. We make our homes a place for no-nos for kids. Don't touch this and don't touch that and don't sit there and don't do that, right? And wonder why they feel confined and restricted and why they want liberty when they're 12 or 13 and want to fight with you to get it. The last part is the best, of course. Beautiful surroundings is the name of the last two paragraphs. God loves the beautiful. Everything beautiful in this life, truly beautiful, He's made Himself. He has clothed the earth and the heavens with beauty. And with a father's joy, He watches the delight of His children in the things that He's made. Just like you, fathers, with your children. He watches the delight of His children in the things He's made for them. As they rejoice in these things and find so much happiness, He's happy by that fact. So when you and I get happy over the things He's made, He's happy. He desires us to surround our homes with the beauty of natural things. Not man-made. God-made. Natural things. Nearly all dwellers in the country, however poor, could have about their homes a bit of grassy lawn, a few shade trees, flowering shrubbery, or fragrant blossoms. And far more than any artificial adorning will they minister to the happiness of the household. Those simple things right there. They'll bring into the home life a softening, refining influence, strengthening the love of nature, and drawing the members of the household nearer to one another and nearer to God. What will nature do? Those things out in the country, no matter how poor you are, grassy lawn, few shade trees, flowering shrubbery, fragrant blossoms, to minister the happiness of the household, to bring a softening, refining influence in the home, strengthen the love of nature. They'll draw the members of the household nearer to one another and nearer to God. You don't believe that, do you? We think that medicine has to be something very complicated and sophisticated. It has to be something that science has worked on for, 15, 20 generations and suddenly discover it. Then it's good for us. And the things that God, who is the Father of all healing, the one who sent us the great physician, the one who puts healing in nature, all these things are there, provided by a God who loves His children. And He said, won't you take the things I've made for your happiness? Won't you look at them? Won't you behold them? Won't you just bask in them? What is so nice is the warm sunshine after cold days. Don't you like to just bask in it? Doesn't spring fever make you feel that way? What is it night like after having refreshing rain when it's been so hot and dry and dusty? And the rain comes down and the air gets fresh and the burning heat is gone and the flowers begin to blossom. Isn't that right? In God's nature are the things that heal nature, and you and I are part of nature, aren't we? If we'd only take the healing things there and utilize them day by day, God would be to us a great physician. He's literally begging us, I think, in these words. I think He's doing some arm twisting. I think He's doing some high-pressure salesmanship and saying, how long is it going to take for me to get you out there and keep you there? How long is it going to take? He doesn't want us to go out there just to enjoy nature by ourselves. He wants us to go out there and get our thinking straight. Our bodies healed and our minds healed and our souls healed so we can come back and offer the balm of Gilead to the city dwellers, right? But we'll never help them out of the ditch as long as we're in the middle of the ditch ourselves, you see? We're in the ditch physically and mentally and spiritually. We don't see clearly. We honestly don't. And we don't understand the Word of God clearly either. And we'll never have the success of the latter rain until we go out with God and have healing of our own souls. And we come back as an example of mental health and physical health and spiritual health. And they said, how did you ever get like that? You say, come along with me. And give them a couple weeks vacation out at your place. You know? On the end of a hoe handle, perhaps. A walk early in the morning. A nice Bible study on the beauties of God, the goodness of God. And just little by little, you see, they'll begin to see how terrible it has been to live in these hotbeds of sin, and how perverted they've become, and how unhealthy in their inmost souls, and how just tightened up emotionally and physically because they live in these places. And the God of all peace wants to give us perfect rest. Perfect rest. How desperately we need that. And how much He longs to give it. Let us not keep Him waiting. Shall we stand for prayer? We're so thankful, our loving Father, that we're the children of the living God. And that long before we existed, He provided for all our needs because He loves us so much. We, along with nature, are the work of His hands. And He wants to make us all over again in that perfect likeness of God. And here in nature, He's provided the things in which we can behold Him in all His goodness and all His glory, in which we can rejoice because these are things originally ordained for man's happiness. Lord, bless us. Change our thinking. Get us out of this rut of living. Turn our hearts away in repentance from the things that drag us down, the things that waste away our energies, the things that destroy and corrupt. Take us out into places where our very life will be more like that of God. Bless our children. Make us a blessing to them in the choice of where we live. And somehow by Thy marvelous grace, may we be transformed totally, physically, mentally, and spiritually, an example to the whole world of the healing of the Lord. And grant, Lord, that we'll not only think of ourselves, but as our own souls are healed, we'll love others as Christ has loved them, and we'll go back to find them and bring them out, that they too might be restored to the likeness of God. Bless us, heal us, and save us, for we ask it in Jesus' name.